What I want to do now, well, first, before we start, I want to pick up on some questions that people have asked me during the break between the last semester and this semester. And then I want to get to some of the questions that were asked at the end of last class, and then we'll start class number two. So let me begin. Those who are with us last semester, remember we dealt with Rabbi Shlomo Yosef Zevin and his attitude towards many things, including his view of Zionism. Somehow he was a big Zionist, but not a Messianic Zionist. Very similar to Rabbi Soloveitchik in that respect. Subsequent to the class, I picked up this book. It's a book on Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook. By the way, his picture is in here. What you're looking at is our very own Yisrael Kashkin, who put out this nice poster. You can get it for your sukkah and hang it on the wall. And he says it's inspired by these classes, so I thank him for that. In this book on Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, I'm going to put this away now. Support. If you can close it up, I can't close up the picture because I want to show you some other pictures. So maybe you can close it up for me. In this book, which is on Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, the Shitulei Haglima, on page 125, it talks about there's a famous essay by Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and it's called, well, more like it's not really an essay, it's a proclamation. It's known as Mizmor Yud Tet, the 19th Mizmor for the State of Israel. And it's what he, on Yom HaTzma'ut, in the 19th anniversary of the State of Israel, he gave his, view of the state. And why did he, motivated him to do that? According to this book, it was Rav Zevin, publicizing his position that, quote, we don't know if this state is really the culmination or the coming to fruition of the prophetic words, the prophecies. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda's response was very sharply, "Madnasei kot v'chosar vadod." What's the question? The vadai. Of course, we know with certainty that the state of Israel is the fulfillment of the words of the prophets. So, although he was very respectful of Rav Zevin, Rav Zevin's lack of certainty about the Geula and that the state of Israel was part of it got Rav Tzvi Yehuda very upset, as well as what Rav Soloveitchik said. Okay, what else? I was asked a few things here. In the summer, someone emailed me. I had mentioned that the Chassam Sofer's famous expression, Chadash Asr Min HaTorah, was said about, not about chumras, but about kulas, that is, leniencies, it was defending leniencies. That is, we don't want chadash, we don't want stringencies, although we mostly assume that Chadash Asr Min HaTorah is against reform or something, we don't want to be more liberal. This was to prevent greater stringencies. So let me explain to you what I was referring to. If you look in his Tshuvot, Yoredeya, number 19, right at the beginning there, he's talking about various customs which are problematic. But great people advocated them. And then he mentions the custom of Chadash, the issue of Yashan. Why is it that we're not makpid on Yashan? And he says that people have tried to justify this custom. And then he says, he says, and regarding, there's other matters as well, that we shouldn't be too quick to be mechadesh and isser, to say that something's forbidden, if the people have done it. That is, in the direction of the greatest stringency. And then he says, certainly we shouldn't, come up with a new heterim if people are doing something. Ki minhag Yisrael Torahi. Because the minhag of Jews is Torah. And this is the first time he uses the expression. He says that chadash is forbidden in all circumstances, and what's old is what's good. So he does throw in that also you shouldn't make new heterim that we haven't done, but the whole point of the paragraph here is, like I said, that it's a justification for the fact that certain things are problematic, like why is it that we are not, you know, we're eating chadash. He says, nevertheless, this is the minhag, and kamatachu leyashev minhag hetzer b'chadash lifnei omer v'hakol leyashev haminhag. And then he says, a baal nefesh should be machmir, but nevertheless, v'chein miyotuva ein lamar l'chadesh yisur. You shouldn't go and put in an isser, something which people are doing. So this is the paragraph I'm talking about, where the primary purpose of it is to justify, really justify any changes. But the stress in here is trying to put in stringencies for something that people have already been practicing. Two more things before we start. Actually, I want to get to the questions. We spoke about this book last semester, Mesoras Moshe, and I just want to call your new stuff about Ramosha Feinstein. I want to call your attention to two things that related to this class. If you recall, going way back in the classes on Rav Nissim, I showed the letter that Rav Nissim wrote to the Chavetz Chaim, asking him why there's no Mishnah Brura on Yoredeya. And and the Chavetz Chaim's response that, you know, he doesn't really have, he's busy, etc., but he didn't say there's a problem having that. In this book, Ramosha Feinstein says that it was good that there's no Mishnah Brura on Yoredeya, because this is the sort of thing that you shouldn't decide by yourself, you should ask a question about. Whereas, the laws in the Mishnah Brura, anyone could read them and know the halacha. More important, though, I think, for what we've done is why I opened this page, is because I think you'll find this really interesting. This is on page 585. It says that Rabbi Rav Moshe replied to Rabbi S. from Cleveland. I don't know who Rabbi S. is. Who asked him, is it permissible for him to become the head of, the national head of Hillel? I don't know who Rabbi S. would be. Maybe someone of you listening know. I know that Frimmer was a big person, Rabbi Frimmer in Hillel. I think it was in Hillel, but I don't know who that is. So the question was that, you know, if you're the head of Hillel, you have to put on events. There's going to be Rikudei Taruvos, there's mixed dancing. You have to be involved. If you're the head of Hillel, you have to make sure that the Reform have a minyan and the Conservative have a minyan. And, is that a halachic problem? If you're the head rabbi of Hillel and you're going to give money and other things to put on dances, to hire people to run the Reform service, is that a question? And he went to Rav Moshe because he said, well, I'll be able to influence them. On the other hand, there's perhaps halachic questions. So what does Rav Moshe say? I think it's unbelievable, his answer. Rav Moshe says, if you think you can help by being involved in Hillel, help for the better, then you shouldn't avoid taking it. You should take it. And what does Rav Moshe say? Quote, "Hello, ein hein goyim shirotzim mitzayir, so shechim akabel kol mitzvot." We're dealing with Jews here in Hillel, non-religious Jews. We're not dealing with non-Jews. With non-Jews, if they want to convert, they have to accept all the mitzvot. These are not non-Jews. They don't have to. They're not going to accept all the mitzvot. We can't force them to, and they don't need to. You know, that's not. They don't know anything about this. You know, they just want to have some Jewish activities, and we're not obligated to force it down their throat. Hein Yisraelim shatar ratzal karev. These are Jews that you want to bring close. Ubavadai mash efshar lashpi alehem. What you can, be mashpi on them. Then you should. Those things that they think are, easy, that you can be mashpi on them, that's good. And what else? Mash nishar nishar. What you can't help, you can't help. So it's not an outstrip mentality here. Ramosh is saying that, I think this is a great line. That Tahalo ein hein goyim shirotzim likayer sushrichim akabel kol mitzvot. You can't go into a Hillel building and tell everyone there that if you want to be part of this institution, you have to follow all the mitzvot. We're not dealing with non-Jews here. We're dealing with Jews. Finally, and the last thing I want to call your attention to is I'll give you another thing next week from Masoret Moshe. Some other things I want to get to, but let's now return to last week's class. And I want to respond to some of the questions at the end quickly before we start. And one question in particular, let me put away these other things. I used the term extremist Haredim last class. And someone wanted to know why I use that term. Extremist Ashkenazi Haredim. So let me explain why I use the term. We spoke in the classes on Rav Avadi Yosef about his view of the Shemitah, the Heter Mechira. And, you know, the Haredim, Ashkenazi Haredim, obviously had a different perspective on it. What I mean when I say extremist Ashkenazi Haredim is you have a situation, for example, where you have a Haredi chief rabbi, or one put in by the Haredim, the last one, Metzger. And as part of the deal, he was to ensure that there would be no sale of during a sabbatical year, no Heter Mechira. So all the land of the state of Israel was sold in Rav Avadi Yosef's house, last Shemitah. I call that extremism. Why? Because it's fine if you're a Haredi and you don't accept the Heter Mechira. And Rav Avadi himself says it's best not to hold in the Heter Mechira. But what the fact is that there's a lot of people who are not going to follow it. And if you don't have a Heter Mechira, they're going to work the land. And there are Heterim for it. So if your position is that my way is correct and I'm not going to allow anyone else, I think that's extremist. It's no different than if there's an argument about an Erev in town, and because you hold, or your posek holds, that you can't have an Erev, even though other poskim hold you can, that you're going to go to the government and try to make sure that the government doesn't give permission to have the Erev or anything like that. That I think that's extremist, that you insist that everyone has to follow your interpretation of the law. It's not enough for you to follow it, but everyone else. That's what I meant when I referred to extremist Ashkenazi Haredim. Actually, I want to get started. So I'm going to hold off on the questions that I was asked last week. I made a copy of them. And at the end of the session, I will respond to all the questions from last week as well as new questions. But let's pick up. If you recall, we ended last class. I was talking about how the pressure was put on Rav Avadia to go into churches, one church in particular, for a funeral, and he refused. So let's pick up with that. By not listening to the chief rabbi's request in this matter, and by disagreeing with him in many other areas, his life was made quite difficult. But this chief rabbi wasn't much of a Talmud Chacham. His name was Chaim Nachum Effendi. In fact, according to Rav Avadia, he wasn't even that religious. We've had plenty of examples of, crown rabbis who aren't that religious. We had that in Europe, in Russia. The typical crown rabbi was not really religious, and that's what you had in Egypt. One other area where Rav Avadia locked horns with the chief rabbi is that according to the law in Egypt, I don't know if it was a technical law, but the chief rabbi decided that's the way they had to act for reasons of getting along with the government. Unless there was a civil divorce, you couldn't give a get. That is, you couldn't have a situation where people would be remarrying without being civilly divorced, because technically that's bigamy. And Rav Avadia, you know, these people were foreigners, some of these people, and they couldn't get civil divorces. It was a problem. The government didn't give them divorces, so Rav Avadia gave them divorces and then remarried them. And that created a bit of a problem. We have in America sometimes where people don't get a civil divorce, get remarried religiously without the civil divorce going through. Technically, that would be bigamy if they put it through as a religious marriage. When Rav Avadia arrived in Cairo, he saw another problem in the court system, the Beis Din. The law was, this is Egyptian law, that because they recognized decisions from the Jewish court, there had to be a lawyer on every court. That is, you have a Beis Din of three, you have two Rabbanim, and one lawyer. And in the appeals court, in Egypt they had an appeals court. If you read my last foreign blog post, I spoke about appeals court. Israel has an appeals court, the Beis Din HaGadol, where all the Gedolim, Rav Avadia Yosef, and all the other great figures served on. Its technical name is Beis Din L'Erurim. It's an appeals court. And this was a huge controversy when this was established. When the British took over, and they would not recognize the Batei Din unless there was an appeals court, because they said you can't have a system of government without an appeals system. There's every civilized country has an appeals court, and what's called the Haredim in those days, it's not the Haredim today, the Rav Zonnenfeld faction, they protested this, and they said that this is against Jewish law. In Jewish law, we have this notion that one Beis Din cannot question, overrule another Beis Din. And then Rav Kook and Rav Pesach Frank explained why it was permissible, but the truth of the matter is that this isn't something new. Appeals courts have existed going back to Spain. they existed. And in the Svarim blog post, I spoke about the appeals court in Prague. The major Beis Din in Prague was an appeals Beis Din. So this isn't something. There was an appeals court in Salonika in the 19th and early 20th century, and other places as well. So there was an appeals court in Egypt, and that court you had to have two lawyers on it. Now the problem was, and the chief rabbi permitted this, these lawyers were not religious. So how can they be on a Beis Din? How can a rabbi sit with them? Even if they were religious, which they weren't, but even if they were ignorant of Jewish law. How can you put someone on the Beis Din who's ignorant of Jewish law? They can't be part of a Beis Din. So that was a problem Rav Avadia dealt with. If you look in Yabia Omer, Choshen Mishpat number 1, see, in Rav Avadia's books, he deals with a lot of these problems. He discusses this issue, what he confronted in Egypt. And he says that the situation was intolerable. How did he solve it? He solved it by making it an ordinance, a takana, that from now on, there would be 4 dayanim on the Beis Din. 1 lawyer and 3 real dayanim. So the only thing that really mattered were the dayanim's ruling. And this was, the lawyer was just for the government. Another problem he dealt with was conversions. The practice in Egypt was, and this wasn't just appointed by something from the chief rabbi, this was something from the previous Av Beis Din, who was not at Rav Avadia's level, obviously, but he was a Talmud Chacham. His name was Masraton. He has a volume of tshuvos called Vezot Lihuda, and Rav Avadia always speaks respectfully of him. The practice in Egypt was that when a woman went converted, you had, well, let me say, not Muslims, you could not convert Muslims, but you had many Christians living in Egypt in those days, French, English, and you had cases of conversions. The woman would go into the mikvah, and the dayanim would stay outside, and the woman would immerse in front of a woman. Problem is, that is not allowed. According to Jewish law, the dayanim need to see the woman immerse. I don't need to tell you that that creates a huge sneas problem. How can you have dayanim watching women immerse in the mikvah? Well, Rav Avadia tells us that in the olden days, the mikvahs were so dirty, the water was not clear. What happens is that the dayanim would stand outside. When the woman was in it up to her head, they'd come in and she would immerse, and they couldn't see anything. This is just like a Masiach HaFitumo telling us what it was like, the mikvahs in those days. You can imagine how many women decided they're not going into something like that when who knows what was floating in there. But that's what he tells us. Rav Avadia instituted it, but the problem was now you had clear mikvahs, where you could see. So the dayanim would stay outside. But that's against halacha. So what did Rav Avadia institute? By the way, he thinks even b'diavad it's no good. He instituted that there should be a cloth, like a blanket of sorts, with the hole for her to put her head in, and the dayanim would come in, And this blanket would be across the entire mikvah, so no one could see anything, and then they would watch her dunk in. He also suggested that she can wear loose-fitting clothes, which is not a problem at all. A lot of people don't realize that a woman can go to a mikvah in a bathing suit, she can go in loose-fitting clothes. If you ever have a situation where you're at a river or something, you know, an ocean, there's no mikvah, you can go right in like that. You don't need to get arrested for indecent exposure. And there's an example, though, where he was confronted with a problem in the system, and he fixed it. Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was asked the same question. By the way, this will come back to haunt Rav Avadia, this tshuva. I shouldn't say haunt him, but this will come back to be used against him. In the Sefer I published, which is Kisvei Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the writings of Rabbi Weinberg, volume 1, on Halakha, number 10, he was asked a question from Copenhagen. This very question, how do you convert women? Because how can you send the rabbis in there? And Rav Avadia says, he says also that you cannot have the woman who's helping the convert woman, she has, she doesn't even have to be Jewish. She has no halachic significance. He says that what you should do, the exact same thing, that when the woman is, he gets something different. He says that you should have a little hole outside the door, and when the woman is in there, all you can see is her head. And the rabbis, look through the hole of the door, And then she dunks. And then he says, there's another way of doing it, what I just mentioned, that you put the blanket across. She says that if this is not done, the woman cannot be considered, she can't be considered Jewish. She has to have Gerut or Shemit Chadasha. She has to have a new official Gerut. So, it's funny that Rabbi Weinberg must think that there's some suffix, because he says that the woman can't be regarded not as a Jew and not as a non-Jew. I'm not sure exactly what that means. She's not Jewish because the conversion wasn't 100%, but she's not regarded as non-Jew. She's somewhere in the middle. I think because there's this viewpoint, it's by the Meiri and some others, that you really don't need witnesses to convert. You can convert yourself if there's no witnesses. B'diavad, it's a valid conversion if you can convert yourself. I think that he doesn't explain because he's writing to the head of the community. He's not a Talmud Chacham. What else did Rav Avadya decide in Egypt? Well, it was during his time in Egypt, again, dealing with conversions, that Rav Avadya gave an psak, which I don't think was so relevant in his time. It wasn't that common. But with the mass emigration of Jews from Russia, it became halacha l'maisa almost every day for a period of probably 10 years. He concluded that it is possible for someone to be put to sleep during Bris Milah. This became a big dispute early in the 20th century, with some poskim saying that you had to feel the pain, because that's part of the milah. Others, like Rabbi Weinberg, say that you can do local anesthesia, and Rabbi Avadya says, no, you can put the person to sleep entirely. And as I said, that became the practice of the Russians, routine practice, who came to Israel and are not circumcised, that they went under general anesthesia. As I think anyone would agree, it's a better thing to do. In Egypt, Rav Avadya was exposed to something he hadn't been exposed to yet, also with conversion. Conversion for the sake of marriage. Something we know very well. It actually goes back to Maimonides. There's a famous tshuva, really, of Maimonides, where Maimonides says a man had been intimate with a slave girl, and he wanted to convert her, and really you're not supposed to convert for marriage, but the Rambam says that in order to help Baal Tshuva doesn't mean someone who's not religious, it means someone who sinned and wants to, set matters right. It's better for us to do a small infraction, that is, convert the woman, even though technically it's not permissible, in order to save this man from, being with this non-Jewish woman. Rav Avadya was confronted with the same situation. Mostly it was men, sometimes women, mostly men got involved with non-Jewish women. And if you don't convert them, they're going to be involved. We're not dealing with tzaddikim here. These men were going to be involved with these women, whether they were converted or not. So the men are not tzaddikim, and the women, the only reason they're converting is for their husbands, and of course they were going to stay with their husbands, or the man they're going to marry, whether or not they converted. So as I said, we're not dealing with tzaddikim. However, if they were converted, the expectation was that they'd be part of the community, they'd give their kids a Jewish education. Rav Avadya says, we don't go looking too hard, we don't ask too many questions. Listen very carefully to what I say, because this becomes the standard of Rav Avadya Yosef, very different than what became the standard in recent years in Israel. As long as there is no umdana demuchach, as long as there's no guarantee that someone who converts is not going to be religious, we can convert them. And if they decide later to be non-religious, to be Mechal Shabbos, it's not our problem. After the fact, it's fine. What would be what he regards as something which is known, like if someone's job is to work on Saturday, that's their job, and they're converting, and then they tell you, or it's understood that they're going to continue working on Saturday, then you can't convert them. However, otherwise, you can convert them, you teach them all, and you don't ask too many questions. Rav Avadya affirmed this approach again, was it last year or the year before, when in the great dispute over the army conversions. These are conversions carried out in the Israeli army when the people, for the most part, almost completely, I think, are not what we would regard as Orthodox, and people wanted to say that these are invalid conversions. These conversions, I think, were regarded as even worse than Rabbi Druckmann's conversions, because in the army it was done as a whole system to convert these people. That was the chance to, you wanted them to get out of the army Jewish so that when they got married, they'd marry another Jew, and that was the way to solve the problem of all these hundreds of thousands of Russians. Rav Avadia wrote a letter affirming that the conversions are valid, and that really ended all the disputes. See, despite Rav Avadia's Haredi turn in recent, the last two decades, when push came to shove, he really showed that he was a man of the people of Klal Yisrael and went back to his old position. When he ran for chief rabbi in 1973, he said that unlike the Ashkenazim, the Sephardic poskim have always adopted the approach of Beit Hillel. That is, the approach of leniency. And if you look online on YouTube, one of the last interview he ever gave to Avishai Ben Chaim, the Haredi affairs correspondent for Haaretz, and he's sitting right there with his son, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, he says that the purpose of halacha is not to make life difficult, and we try to find leniencies. Rav Yitzchak explained what his father's position was on these army conversions. He said that there is the basic halacha, that the diavad, it's valid, it works, and then there's the higher levels, and we should strive for higher levels. And when you convert people, you should try to, go for a higher level. However, if someone was converted based on the army standard, it is 100% valid conversion ex post facto, and these people are to be regarded as Jews. We see, and it's the same approach that he had in Egypt some 50 years, even more, 60 years before, that as long as no one publicly protests and says, well, I don't accept this, I'm going to violate it, we don't need to ask too many questions. In this series of Shiurim, we've seen this approach with Rav Chaim Ozer Gruzinski, the Gadol Hador in his day. We've seen it with Rav W. C. Hoffman. We saw it with Rav Unterman. We saw it with Rav Goren. I think I'm correct in the case I made that just as many great poskim adopted the liberal approach about conversion as those who adopted the stringent approach. Today, if you tell people this, they think you're strange or something because it doesn't fit in with what we're confronting. But anyone who's over 30 years old knows plenty of people who were converted in Israel or America, and they weren't exactly the biggest tzaddikim when they converted. And Rav Moshe Feinstein in the Tshuva speaks about this. He himself says that he doesn't want to convert people unless they're willing, to really commit the way he wants them to commit, but he says that he knows that other rabbanim have a more liberal perspective, and Rav Avadia was one of those. Getting back to Cairo, kashrus was a big problem when Rav Avadia came there, because he tells us that most of the shochtim were not reliable. And much of Rav Avadia's time was spent dealing with this situation. Now, this is not an easy thing, because the shochtim were a group. It was like a union. And they were not used to taking orders from anyone. Furthermore, there were problems with the Arabs. Arabs would bring cows to be shechted. And, violence resulted from this, because one shochet was injured so much, he had to go to the hospital. Why was there violence? Because the Arabs put pressure on the shochtim. If the shochtim would say that it's not kosher, they shecht it and then they check it and see. It's not like today where you had a rabbi check it. The shochet shechts it and then he looks and he determines whether it's kosher. If he'd say it's not kosher, that means that the Arab who has the cow, he doesn't get as much money for it. And they got very angry because they wanted to sell it to the Jews where they made more money. Rav Avadia was able to appoint shochtim from his students at the yeshiva. Ava V'Achva, that's the yeshiva he was brought into. The situation was so bad, there were so few good shochtim, that he told one of his students, who was an Avel, in mourning during Shiva, that he should still continue shechting, because the people needed the meat. Those of you who know Rabbi Meir Schuster, he stays at the Kotel, or he's not now he's very ill. But for years, he was the man who, if you went to the Western Wall, he saw you and he set you up for Shabbos, him and a guy named Jeff Seidel. And he got people into the various yeshivas. He started a place called the Heritage House in the Old City. I know it well because my father was honored by the Heritage House. Actually, he was honored in October of 2001 and was supposed to be in the World Trade Center. So after the World Trade Center was knocked down, they scrambled, they found another place, but there's a room there named after my grandparents. So I know the Heritage House, but when Meir Schuster, Rabbi Meir Schuster, was sitting Shiva, he asked Rabbi Yashiv, does he need to sit Shiva? Because he felt that it was Pikuach Nefesh. Every single day he's at the wall, he meets people. And he doesn't save their lives, but he saves their souls, or certainly there's a possibility he will, and he did save many souls. And we know that saving a Jew religiously is just as saying really just as important as saving them physically. And he said to Rav Elyashiv that if I'm sitting Shiva, that's 7 days, 6.5 days, whatever, that I will be giving up the opportunity. And Rav Elyashiv said, this is what the story we heard. We didn't hear it from Rabbi Schuster, we heard it from one of his assistants, that Rav Elyashiv's response was, you're right, you shouldn't sit Shiva technically, and you could go out. However, it wouldn't look properly. People would assume, would attack you, they'd say you're not religious, they wouldn't understand it. To me, that's a very strange answer, because if it really is pikuach nefesh, so who cares what people say? And I don't think people would, what would they say? They would say, and people would say, Rav Elyashiv gave up stock. And I think everyone, even the most extreme people, could understand that. But that's what we were told, that Rav Elyashiv said that technically you don't need to sit Shiva, but it wouldn't look... maybe Rav Elyashiv just told him that. Maybe Rav Elyashiv thought for his own mental health he needs to sit Shiva. And the reason he gave was not the real reason, because then Rabbi Schuster would say, no, my mental health is fine. Because look, the Chazal told us about Shiva. There's a reason we need Shiva. If it was up to us, you know, some people go back to work the next day. So I'm not sure that that's the real reason, but Rav Elyashiv did tell him that technically you could go out and it would be fine. And Rav Avadia did say, halacha amaisa, to one of his students to continue shechting during Shiva. Rav Avadia also, or as they called him, Chacham Avadia put a lot of pressure on the Kehillah, the community leaders, to fire the shochtim who were unreliable. Remember, he wasn't even 30 years old at this time, and he's going up against these shochtim and their backers in the community. This says a lot for his courage. Another case he describes appears in Yabia Omer, Volume 1, Or HaChaim, Number 30, and this is a tshuva he wrote in Sivan of 1948. He tells us that in Egypt, the practice was to shecht 3 times a week. Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and you'd go pick up your meat. That's when you got your meat. It's not like today where you have supermarkets. You went to the butcher. When Yom Tov fell on one of those days, it's a Yom Tov falls on Tuesday. Sukkot, let's say. First day of Sukkot falls on Tuesday. The shochtim would also shecht. Or second day is on Tuesday. The shochtim would shecht. Not for use on Yom Tov, but for whenever. For use after the holiday. Now, there are opinions. Everyone knows you can shecht on Yom Tov if you need the meat. Let's say it's in the morning and I'm going to have my suda later in the afternoon. I can shecht a cow or a chicken or whatever I want to eat later in the day. However, what about if I don't need it for that day? Well, there is an opinion mentioned in the Rishonim that even if I'm not going to eat the cow today, but I have the cow here, and I might not have the cow later, I can shecht the cow now, and even though I'm not going to eat it, and I'm not going to eat it maybe for 3 weeks, as long as I eat a kazayit, an olive's worth, and that's the measurement, I can eat it. This is what we call a legal fiction, a ha'arama, but that's an opinion found in the Rishonim. Others say that you can only shecht if the animal... if you're going to lose the animal by not shechting now. Like maybe someone's going to take it, but if you shecht it now, you can have it. That's the example I give, that if you have the cow here, you're right here, but maybe if you have to leave, and you're not going to be able to shecht it, or someone's going to take it. But the example given in the sources is that if the animal is sick, and you're afraid if you don't shecht it now, it's going to die, and then you'll lose all the money, you know, because they're on kids. I think that's also a strange example, because... who's going to shecht an animal if it's sick? Maybe they didn't realize how dangerous that is. But it doesn't matter. If either case, there is an opinion that if you're going to lose the money, this is the Rashba, I believe, if you're going to lose the money, you can shecht. Others, however, say, no, you can never shecht on Yom Tov unless you're going to eat the animal. You need this animal for the food. You're going to eat it. The expression that they use, the formulation, is that you're going to eat it at the next Suda. I don't think, I have to check, I don't think that means literally the next suda. I think it means on the holiday, like if it's in the morning and you have no food for dinner, but you have food for lunch, I think that counts. So be that as it may, quite apart from the halachic matter regarding shechting, Rav Avadia tells us that the people would come and buy the meat, which is a complete violation. That is, the shochtim would shech the meat on Tuesday, and people would come in the store on Yom Tov and buy the meat. How could you do that? Quite apart from the fact that we're dealing with shochtim who are mechalei Yom Tov, so how can they be good shochtim? Perhaps there's a terim for that, you can't have a situation where you're shechting the meat and then selling it. And he was able to actually stop the shlita on Yom Tov. It's one of the areas he was able to succeed. With one shochet, things got so bad that the shochet hired some locals, non-Jews, to attack Rav Avadia. He describes this, and I'll read you in a minute. They came to his home and were screaming threats and banging on the door, but he remained inside and was safe. He describes this, those who did Abiy Omer, in Volume 9, Choshen Mishpat number 2. And let me read, just summarize for you the last paragraph. He says, you know, when I came here, there was many problems here. I tried to stop it, because the Beis Din that preceded me didn't do a good job in this matter. And all they were concerned with was making sure that there was one shochet did not move in on another shochet's territory. And then he says that there are very few people learning Shlita. Everyone considered himself in charge of everything. And then he mentions a name, or gives the abbreviation, of one shochet, Dalet Aleph, who I suffered very much from him because I removed him from being a shochet. He didn't check his knife properly, and many times I found that the knife had problems. So what did he do? He hired people to beat me. And they threatened, until the religious people threatened them to leave me alone. And then there's another shochet, and he gives his name, Shin Akuva Shin Reish Yud, Shem Rishayim Yerkov. That's the worst, that's like Yimach Shemo. What did this guy do? He would feed Jews tarfus, and he had a store to sell meat, and it was suspected that he was selling camel meat. And Rav Avadia says, I was able to force him out, as I wrote elsewhere. And then, however, he tried to kill me. He tried to chase after me to kill me, but God was with me. Now, this guy who sold the camel meat, they actually found him selling camel meat, they required that he, Rav Avadia says here in one, that he was able to remove him, but it wasn't a permanent removal. He was able to come back in. Rav Avadia allowed him to come sell meat again on the condition that if he ever found him selling non-kosher, they would never give him hashgacha again, and he was forced to pay for hashgacha that cost him a lot of money. He was the chief shochet in Cairo. This is not something I don't think we can imagine. If you imagine if we found, maybe I'm wrong, we found a butcher selling trace meat, and we say to him, we remove the hashgacha, but we say we're going to give back the hashgacha, but you have to, pay for the hashgacha. You have to make sure there's hashgacha on you. I don't know, I think we'd ever trust him again. Before, but in Egypt, the situation was, first of all, this guy was the chief shochet. He was the number one shochet. Second of all, he didn't have any hashgacha before. The hashgacha is the rabbi would come once in a while and check the knife. But you didn't have hashgacha all the time, and the people were not reliable. Really, it's not that much different than what we used to have in our country. Growing up, I remember you had all these butchers. They were not Shomer Shabbos people. They were under hashgacha. It was a Yotzei V'Nichnas hashgacha, but who knows how often the guy came. Now, this chief shochet, though, he hired two Arabs to attack Rav Avadia. They were to throw acid in his face. Instead, they threw it in the face of another person, Yehuda Gabai, who looked like Rav Avadia, who was a chazan, and also had a beard. Only a little got on his face. But can you imagine? They tried to throw acid on Rav Avadia's face, and they actually threw it on someone else. The shochet was sentenced to 6 months in jail. He later asked for forgiveness, and Rav Avadia allowed him to resume being a shochet again. But the Mashkiach had to come into his store 3 times a day. There's no question that Rav Avadia, if he had his way, would never have allowed this guy to be a shochet again. He calls him Shem Rishon Yerkov, but he didn't have the control. How a community would allow someone who hired someone, who was sentenced to jail, threw acid on the rabbi's face, to allow him to once again become a shochet is beyond imagination. But these shochetim, they had friends, they had powerful people. This shochet, by the way, goes on Aliyah and continues harassing Rav Avadia in Israel. Because in Israel, Rav Avadia went to Rav Nissim. He describes it. And he made sure that Rav Nissim knew who he was, and the man was not permitted to become a shochet in Israel. So finally, he was pushed out. Rav Avadia also made sure that no shochet who sent his kids to non-Jewish schools would receive hashgacha. That's where he, for shochetim whose wives didn't cover their hair, things like that, he wasn't knocked it on. But a shochet who doesn't give his children a Jewish education, that 100%, he would not give hashgacha to him. He tried to improve religious life in other ways. The practice in Egypt was that a woman doesn't go to the mikveh after giving birth until 40 days after a boy and 80 days after a girl. Some of you might know that the Rambam calls this a heretical practice. It's like a Sadducean practice. And Rav Avadia was able to get rid of it. This is a practice, by the way, that goes back hundreds of years. And he was able to uproot it. If you read Yabia Omer, his big volumes, 10 volumes that look like this, he discusses many of the problems that he had in Egypt, and he has responsa from his time in Egypt that dealt with all these things. I mentioned already a number of them. He also was, as we say, Mohammed Schut, defended many practices. Practices that on the face of it were problematic. And others he abolished. In Yabia Omer, Volume 3, Ibn Ezra, Number 8, he deals with, you'll find this interesting, because we violate it all the time, according to him, sitting during the Sheva Brachos at the Chuppah. He argues that this is incorrect and everyone must stand during the Sheva Brachos. And he cites reasons, sources for that, but the main reason is that at least for one bracha you have to stand. There's a bracha for Klal Yisrael on the Sheva Brachot. Mehera Hashem Alkeni Shama Be'ar Yehuda. That's a bracha for the Jews as a whole. And a bracha for the Klal, he says, must be standing. I've never seen in my entire life, I don't think ever seen anyone stand, get up and stand for that bracha. But maybe some of you have seen it. I don't know how many of you are new and how many have been with us for a long time. Those who have been with us for a long time remember it's probably 3-4 years ago I spoke about the practice of standing up for Aliyah, for not for the Kriyas HaTorah. That's all, in a place like Slabodka, they used to stand up for Kriyas HaTorah, but that's about the practice of standing up for the Birkas HaTorah. And we went through that whole sugya. Just this last Shabbos, I'm in shul, and some guy keeps standing up for the Birkas HaTorah, and no one else is. That's another example of where you could show us the sources that say you should stand up, but as when they asked Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he said, look around, no one stands. So you want to start standing when no one stands? In other words, if you're in a shul, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach doesn't stand up, and none of the other Gedolei Yisrael stand up, you're going to start standing up because it says in a source, and it says in the Mishnah Berurah. But Rav Shlomo Zalman's point was, we don't follow the Mishnah Berurah. And if you, those who are with me, you might recall, I showed you in the Kaf HaChayim, he actually mentions that for Kabbalistic reasons, you shouldn't stand up. So if you want to justify the minhag that way of sitting down, you could say it's Kabbalistic. But we don't do it, and I don't know in the Sephardic world if anyone does it either. Another interesting minhag is discussed in Yabia Omer, Volume 3, Orachaim, Number 23. The practice in Egypt, see, the first practice I just told you about, the Sheva Brachos, he got rid of it. Here's an example of a practice that he defended that will appear, I think, to most people even more problematic. The practice was that a non-Jew would sit right off the sanctuary during davening on Shabbos morning and write down all the donations to be collected after Shabbos. They would sell the aliyahs. In Rav Avadia's minyan, when I davened in Rav Avadia's minyan, before he moved to Har Nof, he used to daven in the Great Synagogue. If when you went in the Great Synagogue on the right side there, as you walked in, right side, maybe it was the left side, I forget now, there was a small Sephardic minyan, maybe 75 people could hold, and that was his minyan. And that was the first time I ever saw selling an aliyah Shabbos morning. We all know for simplest Torah, but selling the aliyah, it went on probably for 20 minutes, and it struck me as very un-Shabbistic, but it's obviously allowed, and it's for tzedakah. So in Egypt, they also would sell it. But how do you remember who's who? How do you guarantee you get the money? Well, a non-Jew would write it down, and then they collect the money after Shabbos. Is that proper? Rav Avadia in the Tshuva says, he doesn't like the custom. But he says that it's those shuls that have this minhag, not the minhag of the bidding for aliyahs. That he has no problem with. I'm talking about having a non-Jew record it. Being in the shul and recording it, he says, don't start it in new minyanim, but if the shul already has this minhag, it can you can continue it. And this minhag is found to this day at the Ava V'Achva shul in Brooklyn, where a non-Jew will record the donations, and money will be collected after Shabbos. We see from another response in Yabia Omer, Volume 1, Yerdei, number 11, that many otherwise observant Jews had to work on Shabbos, or they wouldn't have a job. So how does Rav Avadya relate to them? Well, let me tell you, let me read you a bit what he says. He said that many of these people who work on Shabbos, when they leave their work, they are careful not to shalach al Shabbat, and they don't smoke on Shabbos. And many of them, some of them, chelk mehem, go on Shabbos to an early minyan so they can get to their work in time. This was, we had this in America, on the Lower East Side. You had 6:30 a.m. Shabbos minyan so that people can go work. And inside, they cry about that they have to be violate Shabbos. And he says, regarding these people, Barur Shefshar Hakel B'Magam B'Yayin, he says that these people are not to be regarded as Machale Shabbos. We don't have problems with their wine or anything else. These are good Jews who happen to be sinning. But they don't want to be sinning, but they feel they have no choice. And then he goes on to explain that, you know, the halachic status, we know that one person, he was able to influence this person, so he said, you have to go on Aliyah. The story is told by the grandson, because at least in Israel, you'll be able to, won't have to work, and the man came to Israel and was able to get a job, obviously. We don't work on Shabbos. So you see that we're dealing with a population here, just like in America. People sometimes think the Sephardic population was that different. We had the exact same thing in America, the non-observant Orthodox. The people who believed, you know, they had the Shabbos meals, and they believed in Shabbos, but they felt they had no choice. There was no Erev in Cairo. And this also created a problem. And Rav Avadya discusses it in Yabia Omer, Volume 8. Here was the problem. You had a rabbi, one of the rabbis in Cairo, that put together the Shabbos sheets, which in Israel, they're everywhere, most of our shuls. Someone got very angry. He says it's, I saw someone online a few years ago says it creates a huge shameless problem, because what are we going to do with all these sheets? I don't know. I don't know why these are shameless. If it doesn't have Hashem's name, I don't see why it's shameless. You're allowed to throw these sheets out, and certainly if they're English, you're allowed to, as long as they're wrapped properly, and you know, you could throw them out. And I think most poskim say you can, even real shameless, you can recycle it. But you had this rabbi produced every Shabbos, a very nice idea. It would have been in French, incidentally, because that's what the Jews there spoke at this time. Oh, the more enlightened, economically secure Jews spoke in French. And he gave it out to them every Shabbos, some stuff about the Parsha, very nice. But Rav Avadya didn't think so. He said that you're giving it to them, and they're going to take it home, and they're carrying on Shabbos. The rabbi's point was, what do you mean they're carrying on Shabbos? I'm just giving it to them. What they do with it is what they do with it. Second of all, who cares if they're carrying on Shabbos? As it is, at least the rabbi said, all these people are carrying their keys. They're carrying handkerchiefs. They're carrying anyway. So at least now they're carrying Torah. And that was the rabbi's, the other rabbi's case. And Rav Avadya went to the chief rabbi to try to get the chief rabbi to order this other rabbi to stop, and the chief rabbi refused to. And Rav Avadya describes in the tshuva that this other rabbi was wrong. That there still is an idea that just because you're carrying one thing, for everything you carry on Shabbos, it increases the Isser. Let me read you some of his language here. I don't need to read the language, but he speaks about there's a riboy shir behotza. That means that, you know, if you're just because you're carrying one thing, if you put something else in your pocket, that increases it. And according to some poskim, it's even min ha-Torah, it increases it. And if you're machshil them, if you cause them to sin, it's lifnei iver. You're violating. Don't put a stumbling block. It still, to me, is a difficult decision a bit, because the name of the magazine, by the way, the newsletter, was called Oneg Shabbos. And it would have all sorts of nice things, but I guess the newsletter, it's described here as it gives them about the Parsha Shavua and all sorts of things. But the implication is that it's something you bring home. It must have had also information about probably during the week what's going on, because otherwise, what's the big deal? So there isn't an Erev. Shuls used to give out newsletters on Shabbos without an Erev. No one's telling them to take it home if they choose to take it home. On the other hand, now that I think of it, though, if you know they're going to take it home, by you providing it to them, you're assisting in the sin. You're being machshil. Technically, you might not be, but I don't know if everyone holds technically you are, but you're being machshil at harabim, as we say, but you're giving them the opportunity, so it's definitely not a good thing. And that's why Rav Avadya says you know that they're going to take it home. 100% they're going to take this newsletter home, so you can't give it to them on Shabbos. I'd be interested to know if in America, before we had Erevin, before the 1970s, who had Erevin, if any rabbi in America made the case that it's a problem to give out, I don't know if they gave out the newsletters in those days. In my shul, they put out the weekly newsletter in the back of the shul. I assume they used to do that as well. They put out other papers in the back of the shul, speakers, and people take it and put it in their pocket. According to Rav Avadya, you can't do that. You can't put it out because you're encouraging them to take it. It still is a bit problematic, though, because you're not telling them to. I mean, you're giving them the opportunity, but who says they're going to? There's no guarantee they're going to. It's if I bring my car to a Jewish mechanic Friday afternoon and he has time to do it before Shabbos and he chooses to do it on Shabbos, it's not a problem. In this case, but again, Rav Avadya felt that it was guaranteed they're going to take it home, and if you didn't give it to them, they wouldn't. In which case, that's the definition of Lifnei Iver. If you give them the possibility to do something that without you, they wouldn't have done. The most difficult problem for Rav Avadya. Oh, I see it's already 9:53, so I'm going to stop here and take some questions and respond to the questions. For next class, and we'll finish next class with Rav Avadya, the most difficult problem I'll pick up with was the Jewish hospital in Cairo, because here you had a Jewish hospital supported by the Jewish community, which was serving people non-kosher meat. And the community leaders kept it secret. And as we will see, Rav Avadya, when he found out about it, thought that it was important to keep it secret for a little while to see if he could stop it. But that's where I'll pick up with next class. So I want to now respond to the questions from last week, which I wrote down. And please, if you have anything else based on what we said today, type it in. I was asked last class, let's see if the people who asked are still here. Bill Gewertz pointed out that Rav Avadya is not, I mentioned that he didn't have a secular education. Bill pointed out that his knowledge of mathematics was uneven, skilled at calculation, limited knowledge of basic algebra, not atypical. Yechesko, who I don't see with us, but he listens to it. Yisrael asks, let me pull up the picture that they were dealing with here. This picture. And everyone, you know, they're looking at the hair. Yisrael says, Rav Avadya is wearing a Western-style suit. How far back were Sephardim still wearing traditional garb? Egypt is not Yemen. Egypt, the Jews spoke French, many of them. Others spoke Arabic, but they all dressed Western. Some of them wore fezes and everything, but they dressed Western. So Rav Avadya dressed Western. Rav Avadya would, only when he came back to Israel and he was appointed, as a dayan, did he wear the long black coat. Before that, he wore just, you see how he's wearing, what he looks like. Yisrael also, one of them asks, I can't see it here. Oh yeah, Yeheskel asks, was Rav Avadya's wife's hair okay, according to Rav Avadya? After all, she's showing, I don't know, truthfully. If you look at Rav Avadya's writings, she is showing too much hair there. It could be that this picture, I was going to say it was taken inside. I don't think so. This must have been taken at a photography studio. And we know that often the rabbis didn't have total control of their wives. If you read Rav Avadia's writings, there's no question that he believes that more hair should be covered than what's showing there. Again, this is inside. Maybe there's a heter he thought for inside versus outside. Even with a photographer still indoors, some posting like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik thought that indoors you didn't have to cover your hair at all for anyone, even strangers. So I can't tell you maybe Rav Avadia had a different position later in life than earlier in life. All I can tell you is look at the evidence you see here, but that doesn't, you can't assume that everything you see would have met with Rav Avadia's approval. So I don't have an answer for that. Yisrael also asks, I spoke about the Mishnah Berurah last class, why the Mishnah Berurah took over instead of the Aruch HaShulchan. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Chavetz Chaim got a reputation as a saintly figure, very saintly. And there was legends about the Chavetz Chaim. Chaim Grada, in one of his books, deals with the Chavetz Chaim, and you get a sense of how people relate with the Chavetz Chaim. I think that might be why the Mishnah Berurah assumed its authority. Also, the Mishnah Berurah is not a code. The Mishnah Berurah is a commentary. It could be that by the time of the Aruch HaShulchan, we passed the era of new codes. You know, a new code was seen to be in conflict with the Shulchan Aruch. You know, what are you going to abandon the Shulchan Aruch or the Aruch HaShulchan? The only thing that could succeed is a commentary. That is a code in the form of the commentary, so you study the Shulchan Aruch with the Mishnah Berurah. It could be that that's the Jewish people, after hundreds of years accepting the Shulchan Aruch, didn't want to move to a new code. Because if you think of it, if you would have accepted the Aruch HaShulchan, that really would have been the end of the Shulchan Aruch as having a central place, because now they would have gone to the Aruch HaShulchan as the code. The Shulchan Aruch would have been for the great scholars, but for someone who just wants to know halacha, you wouldn't need the Shulchan Aruch anymore. You'd have the Aruch HaShulchan. And it could be that that was thought to be too much of a change, too radical, too much of abandonment of tradition. It's 9:58. If anyone has questions, please type them in. We had a bit of a problem last week that the questions, I didn't get them immediately. So when I came back 2 minutes later after I checked out and I wanted to come back in and make sure that everything was okay about sound, then I saw the questions. So let me just first ask, has the sound been good tonight? Someone write in. And second of all, someone write in to know that you can actually write in. That everything is okay, that everything is working properly. This is a bit of a new system. It looks the same as last semester, but there's some little changes here. So I see Bill is typing in. I'll feel very good if I'm told that it was a good sound this time, that we're doing better than the American Healthcare website. Everything's going okay, and you can hear me, and I will feel good when I see someone typing, and I can actually see some writing below me. So that's the two things I want to get before I sign off. I want to see typing, and I want to hear that sound is okay. I'm a little worried now that there's a problem because I don't see any writing at all. Yisrael sent me something, but it didn't go to everyone. It just came privately to me, I think. Let me answer his question. While tech support, you can maybe figure out why Yisrael's did not go to everyone. This is part of the problem, maybe, with this new system. At the bottom of my screen, it says everyone. If you click on everyone, you should be able to type. Yisrael asks, do Sfardim look to ask posting like Rav Elyashiv? Do Ashkenazim look to Rav Avadia? Ashkenazim always looked to Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia was apostate who spanned all groups, and his psakim are not for Sfardim. Some people say things like, to hear a psak of Rav Avadia, for example, just today, I spoke in Riverdale on Rav Avadia. So someone said something about, you know, he gave the heter to eat gelatin, you know, that's a Sfardic for the Sfardim. It's not for the Sfardim. When he gave a psak, it was for everyone, except when certain times he said that this is for Sfardim because they hold like the Shulchan Aruch and this is Rashkenazim, they hold like the Ramah. And on the hardest questions would go to Rav Avadia. With Sfardim or Rav Elyashiv, they did ask him, but less so. First of all, you have to remember that there's a whole group of Sfardim who are pretty Ashkenazified. They've gone to Ashkenazic yeshivas, and they never really adopted Rav Avadia. They went to the Ashkenazic authorities. And quite apart from that, you have Sephardic rabbis who had great respect for people like Rav Yosef. Okay, now I can see. Now I see everything. I'm seeing bad things. That Bill says quality was not so good. Well, let me start up. Here's part of the problem. Last semester, when you put a comment in, it immediately would pop up. Now I have to scroll down. Okay, now I get it. Bill mentions the Chazon Ish and the Srogim. Leah says Rabbi Silver. I don't know who Rabbi Silver is in Cincinnati. It's not Eliezer Silver. Eliezer Silver was never asked to be head of Hillel, and he wouldn't have asked Rav Moshe such a question. Yossi says Rabbi Scheinbaum, Hebrew Academy of Cleveland. Could be. If you know him, you can ask. I don't know. Scott Berman says sound is okay. Video and sound would freeze time to time. So we're getting some people. Bill says it was really bad. Others say it was okay. We're going to have to get to the bottom of this. Yisrael asks, Binyamin says would freeze from time to time. Yisrael says, any guesses as to why he became more Haredi in the last 20 years? You think with age he wouldn't get pulled by the times? I don't have the answer to that, but it is a fact that as in his later years, maybe his children moved him, maybe he was, when he was not in the chief rabbinate, you know, his whole life was Torah study. And if you look at the more religious Zionist world, they have other values other than Torah study. So although he respected that world and always treated them well, unlike others in this camp, you could see that that would not necessarily be his world. Okay, I'm getting the final ruling from tech support that the sound wasn't perfect, better than last week, some freezing. We'll get to the bottom of this, but all in all, not bad. One final thing, Yisrael says, what was his position regarding secular studies? Rav Avadia's daughter opened up a school for Haredim to get secular educations. He believed in secular education for those people who were not studying Torah. He was opposed to forcing people out of the yeshivas. He believed in all these exemptions and everything. So in that sense, he's not what we would call modern Orthodox or anything like that. However, for those who were not in the yeshivas, he had no problems with secular studies. He even has a responsum in Yechaveh Da'at. The question is, is it okay to get a degree, like a master's or PhD, in Jewish studies? Because this isn't Torah Lishma. You're studying Torah in order to get a degree. And Rav Avadia says, it's not the best thing. Your Torah study should be Lishma, but it is 100% permissible to do that, to study Torah for the sake of a degree. And those of us who've gotten PhDs or masters know that you study a lot of Torah. So this is really an Ashkenazic hang-up. The Ashkenazi Haredi hang up about the Zionism. As I mentioned before, the Sephardi never had this. The leaders of the Sephardic world have always been the chief rabbis who have always been sympathetic, if not openly Zionistic, like Rav Avadia, Rav Uziel, or Mordechai Eliyahu. And the Sephardim have never had this hang up on secular studies. It's the mishagat of the Ashkenazim, but for good reason, because the Ashkenazim confronted in Europe the Reform movement, the Haskalah. So there was a backlash in the other direction. The Sephardim never had this. They never developed any sort of extremism. With that, let me say goodnight to everyone. Glad to have you here. Tell everyone that things are working better, and look forward to seeing everyone next week. Good night.